Good morning. I call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 9:03 a.m. on Thursday, February 13th, 2025. Present today are Representative Hannon, Representative Tomaszewski, Representative Galvin, Co-Chair Foster, myself, Co-Chair Josephson. Also present today are our House Finance Committee staff, Committee Assistant Helen Phillips, Paige Reed-Gardiniere, Secretary Bree Wiley, Secretary Leah Frazier. Before we start, please mute your cell phones. In today's meeting, we'll hear a presentation on Medicaid 101. This was presented to the Senate, and I thought, in fairness, that the House should also keep up with the Senate in its effort to learn all we can. With us today from the Department is Deputy Commissioner Emily Ritchie. Deputy Commissioner, if you'll come to the desk. The table. Put yourself on the record and begin your presentation.
Good morning.
Good morning.
For the record, my name is Emily Ritchie. I'm Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Health, and I will be joined today at different points in the presentation by other members of the team within the Department of Health, including Deb Etheridge, the Director of the Division of Public Assistance, Tony Newman, the Director of the Division of Senior and Disability Services, and Tracy Dompling, the Director of the Division of Behavioral Health. So throughout the presentation, with your permission, Chair, they may come up and join me for some of these slides.
Please.
So moving on to slide two, Alaska's Medicaid program is essential to Alaskans and to our healthcare delivery system. Annually, Alaska Medicaid pays $2.8 billion in federal and state dollars to support Alaska's healthcare system around the state. These dollars are spent in hospitals in communities from Petersburg to Nome, from Fairbanks to Dutch Harbor. They include payments to primary care providers for the services that they're rendering to Alaskans. They include community clinics and community health centers. They include local pharmacies, payments for emergency room physicians, and services to support seniors to support them remaining in their home and their communities and keeping them outside of institutional settings where possible. Every week, the Division of Healthcare Services distributes $252 million in payments to providers. This equates to about $8.5 million in annual claims that are paid out to over 31,000 providers. The Medicaid program provides critical health insurance to over 246,000 Alaskans and is a significant contributor to Alaska's economy. For example, in 2023, the healthcare sector overall in Alaska provided $3.4 billion in direct wages, and healthcare jobs made up 11% of Alaska's workforce. So I really want to thank the committee for taking time today to learn about this important program and the impact that it has on Alaska's healthcare delivery system and Alaska's economy.
Deputy Commissioner, we've been joined by Representatives Allard, Johnson, and Bynum. Yes. Question from Representative Hannon.
Thank you. Thank you for being with us. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Deputy Commissioner, of the $2.8 billion annual spend, how much of that is federal money and how much of that is state money?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, we will speak to that in more detail in later slides, but about $700 million is in state general fund dollars and the remainder is in federal dollars.
Thank you.
Please continue.
So moving on to slide three, Medicaid is an important aspect of Alaska's healthcare delivery system, but it's also an important component of the healthcare delivery system across the United States. So Medicaid is one of the largest public health insurance programs in the United States. In October of 2024, nearly 79 million people in the U.S. were covered through the Medicaid program, and that represents nearly one in four Americans. Within Alaska, Medicaid covers around one in three Alaskans. Medicaid also has an essential role specifically in covering long-term care services and support, so at a federal level, the Medicaid program accounted for 44% of all payments for long-term care services and supports in the U.S., and Medicaid accounts for nearly 18% of national health expenditures. So what is Medicaid, and why is it so important to our systems? Medicaid is a joint federal and state public health insurance program for low-income individuals and their families. Medicaid is intended to support vulnerable populations and provide health insurance so they can access the health care services they need. This includes women, pregnant women, children, elderly individuals, people with disabilities, and low-income adults, as determined by states' eligibility rules. Medicaid is governed by state, by federal guidelines, but states have the ability to design their programs in certain ways within those federal guidelines. So these include things like determining specific eligibility criteria for different groups, which services may be covered, and how the programs may be administered. So, for example, in Alaska, we tend to have a program that is called fee-for-service, meaning we reimburse for services on a fee basis. Other states have chosen to use a Medicaid managed care organization model. These are the types of decisions that can be made on a statewide basis within certain federal guidelines. And each state administers its own Medicaid program, again, tailored in a way to meet their needs and the methods of administration.
Deputy Commissioner, I think we have a question from Representative Tomaszewski.
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair Josephson, through the chair. You just mentioned fee service versus managed care. Can you just real quickly, I mean, which one's cheaper? I mean, what are the pros, cons, that sort of thing?
Through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski, managed care is really a way of providing health insurance through the Medicaid program in a way that mirrors maybe some of the commercial insurance or the employer-sponsored insurance that you might experience for those of us covered today. So the Medicaid program contracts with a insurance provider that then negotiates agreements with a network of providers and agrees to pay them to see Medicaid patients, again, all within federal and state guidelines that are determined. In Alaska, we have a fee-for-service system, meaning that we still have a contract with providers who agree to accept our fees in order to provide services to Medicaid patients. But the state Division of Healthcare Services is effectively paying those providers as they submit fees for their service. So we're not paying an insurance company to establish a network of providers to offer those services and to manage that care. We are paying physicians and healthcare systems directly for the services as Medicaid recipients receive those.
Follow up.
Yes, thank you. So which one is generally, I mean, do states who have managed care, are they generally paying less in their over for their per person per capita? Is it more expensive to do the managed? Is it more expensive to do the fee service?
Through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski, I think it depends. And part of that is because when you compare states on a per capita basis, there are underlying differences between the states that might result in higher or lower per capitated basis. So we all know the costs are more expensive in Alaska. We see that reflected in the cost for providing services to our Medicaid population, which may account for some of the differences when you compare fee-for-service to managed care organizations. It's also difficult to compare because managed care organizations may cover different sets of services within a Medicaid program, so what they cover may not be consistent. But I would say in general there's pros and cons to both approaches. One of the pros to having a fee-for-service system is that the Medicaid program within Alaska is directly managing how the services are paid for, when they're paid for, and who they're paid for. Whereas with a managed care organization, you're establishing a contract with effectively an insurance company to offer those same services. So there's not as much direct management over those claims. A con is that sometimes managed care organizations can provide more comprehensive care or a better set of services or manage the care for Medicaid beneficiaries more effectively. But there is a profit component within the managed care system that is not the same as a fee-for-service system relative to an insurance company managing those claims. So there's pros and cons to both. Alaska does not have a managed care organization within its state Medicaid program, but when I look and talk with other state Medicaid directors around the country, particularly in western regions like Wyoming or Montana, many of those western areas utilize some small form of managed care, but also have significant fee-for-service aspects of their Medicaid program.
And just one more.
Yes, follow.
Thank you, through the chair. So are all medical providers happy with the fees that we pay? Or you said there's a negotiation, there's a process, you have so much you're going to pay for whatever service. Is the hospitals and the providers, are they all in general happy with the system that we have? Or
through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski, I would say no. In general, medical providers are not always pleased with the fees that are established through the Medicaid program. And some of that has to do with overall design within our healthcare delivery system and insurance plans. Typically, payers like Medicare and Medicaid, both of which are public payer programs, tend to have lower fees and a fee schedule versus commercial payers who may have negotiated fees that are higher. So some cost shifting does occur between public payers and the private commercial insurance. And so when we hear from providers dissatisfaction with Medicaid rates or Medicare rates, which is a federal system, that dissatisfaction largely reflects a sense that reimbursements are higher on the commercial side, and, you know, in order to cover the cost of providing their services, they're perhaps cost shifting from public payers to private payers. We are, however, I think, to the degree that we're able to, recognizing the impact on the budget, sensitive to that, and we are currently in the process of undertaking a rate methodology review so that we can look at how the rates in the Medicaid program are established across different categories and if they result in the outcomes we want to see in the delivery system.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson, then Hannon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, just kind of going back into maybe not exactly on this slide, but Medicaid is the federal money is still administered by the state, correct?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, yes. And in a few slides, we'll talk about kind of how that cycle works.
Okay. Well, maybe you have a slide that talks about payment, because if I hear one complaint about Medicaid and from people in my district, it's the fact that they aren't getting doctors. Offices have a hard time getting paid. They seem like to the point this actually affects their businesses. It affects people's health care when they don't get paid timely. And so, you know, I don't know if you can address that or will address that on a future slide, but, from the amount of complaints that I get about that, it's something that needs to be fixed. And I don't know if the in addition to that, I was wondering if a couple of years ago you had some cyber attacks, some problems there with the computer systems. I don't know if that affected Medicaid. I don't know if that affected payment. But anyway, anything that as you go along you can talk about and how Medicaid as far as their speed of pay compares to private insurance, because all the care in the world doesn't do any good if you can't get people paid when they deliver the service.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, you know, we do have providers reach out to us, especially when they've had delay in their claims or payments. I think it's important to put that into context with the $8.5 million claims that are being processed annually. That does not mean that for an individual provider experiencing issues that does not directly impact them. So we do take those seriously. One of the things that we try to evaluate is what do we see as a trend that might have a system effect that is impacting multiple providers with the same root cause, and what are individual issues that might be very specific to the provider. They may have to do with some of the complexities of billing in the Medicaid system. So, for example, a claims clearinghouse may not be carrying the information that the provider has submitted into the MMIS system. So while that might appear as an issue in our Medicaid payment system, the issue is actually in the data clearinghouse. And so teasing that apart can be very, very complicated. I know this afternoon we'll be back in front of the committee to talk about some of the IT changes that we are proposing as part of the Medicaid program to address some of the system challenges we see. I would say in general, like other systems in the state of Alaska, we are reliant on some technology that requires a lot of manual intervention by individuals. And so we do have a Medicaid modernization plan that will build out over the next several years opportunities to improve that infrastructure, to leverage automation, and we're hoping that that results in better service for providers and will allow our staff to be more efficient in their work.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Josephson. Deputy Commissioner, as you were describing managed care versus fee-for-service, in my mind, it seemed like managed care is sort of like an HMO and would only thrive somewhere where you have a variety of providers to negotiate with. And in Alaska, one of our issues seems to be everywhere, limited providers of any kind of service and access to it. Am I understanding managed care correctly? And I mean, it would seem to me like we wouldn't really have an option in Alaska to go to managed care because for so many of our things, there's only one provider of it. Am I understanding that correctly?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon. So just to clarify, managed care organizations can be health maintenance organizations or HMOs, but they do not have to be, right? So a managed care organization could be structured in the same way as the health insurance plan that's offered to state employees or state retirees, right? But that is not a health maintenance organization. I think whenever you're talking about pooling risk across a group of people, part of the key elements of that are how many providers would participate in that network and is the pool big enough to support that risk. And in Alaska, that has been a challenge. And I know the legislature has looked at that at various times over the last 10 years. And, you know, we've stayed within the fee-for-service system that we're using despite looking at that many times.
Thank you.
Am I right that the cost shifting – making a Medicaid patient affordable by requiring more from private payers like Aetna and Blue Cross, that has the advantage, of course, of allowing physicians to treat Medicaid patients and make much less profit. But they don't have to treat Medicaid patients. They elect to. Is that right?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, if a provider enrolls in the Medicaid program and has that provider enrollment, they agree to accept Medicaid patients. I think in general it's important to understand that with any sort of business, there's going to be, especially in healthcare, there's going to be a mix of payment rates from different payers. So even within the commercial side, you have payers that pay different amounts for different funds. In general, the public payers, such as Medicare or Medicaid, tend to pay less than commercial payers. But as we talk a little bit more in the presentation about how some of our rates are structured, within the Medicaid program, many of our rate structures are actually cost-based reimbursements, meaning we are using costs that have been reported to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services for providers, and we use those to establish what the Medicaid rate will be with some additional percentage above that. So it can be very complicated when we're thinking about the actual cost for providing the services and then what the Medicaid fee is to support that.
Okay. Let's move to slide five.
So moving on to slide five, I'd like to ask Director Deb Etheridge to join me to talk a little bit about Medicaid eligibility.
Thank you. For the record, this is Deb Etheridge. I'm the director for the Division of Public Assistance. I'm going to talk a little bit today and about the understanding that Medicaid application process, eligibility categories, and the divisions of public assistance role and how it's essential for shaping effective Medicaid policy, ensuring access to health care for eligible Alaskans. Excuse me. Alaskans have multiple options for applying for Medicaid. We try to ensure accessibility through these variety of options. They can apply online at myalaska.gov. They can apply for Medicaid through the federally facilitated marketplace at healthcare.gov. They can also call in to our virtual contact center to apply. They can come into our Division of Public Assistance offices and meet with an eligibility technician to apply for Medicaid benefits. Or in our rural areas, we have what's called a fee agent. And if a fee agent's there, they can apply with a fee agent and receive an interview. We also accept applications for Medicaid on by mail or by fax. And in Alaska, also to help you, is that once an application is submitted, we make eligibility determinations based on categories of eligibility for Medicaid. We have sort of two buckets of eligibility categories. One is the disability-related Medicaid. So individuals may qualify for disability-related Medicaid if they meet any of these following criteria. They're 65 or older, have a disability, or receive supplemental security income. They also or receive Medicare, live in a nursing home or assisted living facility, receive home and community-based waiver services. So eligibility is determined based on income limits, which vary by household size and by living situation. And additionally, applicants must meet resource tests for this category. for individuals who have a disability, would look like they'd be in this category, but they have additional resources, we also determine whether or not they could fall under an eligibility category called Modified Adjusted Gross Income, or MAGI. And that's the other larger bucket of Medicaid category. So Modified Adjusted Gross Income, MAGI, is for low-income children, pregnant women, families, adults 19 to 64 without dependent children. For the Modified Adjusted Gross Income eligibility category, the household, we look at household size and income, and we follow the IRS guidelines. And unlike disability-related Medicaid, there's no resource test for MAGI Medicaid. What is the role of the Division of Public Assistance? Regardless of Medicaid category, the Division of Public Assistance plays a key role in verifying eligibility and ensuring compliance with the program requirements. We use electronic data sources whenever possible to streamline the verification process, but applicants must meet all eligibility criteria for their specific category, which include the financial need. There's an income and, in some cases, asset tests for the and have program limits. Citizenship or immigration status, applicants must be U.S. citizens or meet specific immigration criteria. Supplemental security number, or social security number, they have to have a valid social security number, that's required. Assignment of rights, and what that means is that applicants must agree to allow Medicaid to recover costs from other sources, such as private health insurance. And then there's resource limits. Some Medicaid programs, as I mentioned before, impose limits on savings and property ownership. Once all of the documentation is submitted, the Division of Public Assistance, Eligibility Assistance, issues a written determination, and that's either approval or denial of Medicaid. We give adequate notice to individuals if we are going to be denying them, and all individuals receive fair hearing. And so once an individual, if they are on Medicaid, eligibility must be renewed annually, and we do that using an ex parte process. What that means is that 60 days before the renewal is due, we check all available electronic resources and verify residency in Alaska. If we can confirm the residency and through our electronic resources, income, and other eligibility criteria, we will automatically renew those individuals, and they will be renewed for an additional year. If we're unable to do that and we're unable to renew them, then what we do is we send a pre-populated or a reduced or smaller renewal form to the individuals, and then they have to return that form, and we will process those renewals. The Medicaid benefits continue during that renewal process. And again, once we do provide a 10-day notice before any negative action is taken. A well-structured Medicaid system really just ensures that eligible individuals can apply, qualify, and maintain coverage without unnecessary barriers. The department and me as the director, I'm working hard towards a Medicaid program entry system that efficiently serves those we need while maintaining accountability and program integrity.
Thank you, Director. We have a question from Representative Galvin.
Thank you. Through the chair, Director, my question is around the 0 to 1 versus 0 to 6 eligibility. My understanding is recently that the governor made a change to allow for coverage for 0 to 1 children who are born from 0 to 1. And correct, I'm not familiar with exactly how that looks or is structured, but I believe that there was 2 years ago he had discussed that he was going to make Alaska more friendly to children and make sure they're covered. And then I think it took a year, year and a half or something to make that happen. Can you confirm that firstly, that is what's going on with coverage for children?
Deputy Commissioner.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, for the record, this is Emily Ricci. I want to make sure that we're thinking about the postpartum extension bill that was passed.
Yes.
And so we appreciate the legislature's support in passing a bill that extended Medicaid enrollment for mothers who had given birth from 60 days after birth to 12 months. So that allowed for coverage for the mother for a longer period of time, and that is in effect.
For the mother and the child, or just the mother?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, there were no changes to the Medicaid enrollment eligibility for the child. That child was already eligible for the first year of birth.
Follow-up? Are other states offering Medicaid for children beyond age one?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, children would be eligible for Medicaid beyond age one, again, depending on the income limits and or categorical eligibility. So that has not changed. They have remained eligible, again, based on that state's structure for the, for eligibility, for those eligibility categories.
Follow-up?
Follow-up.
So the zero to one, they also must meet an eligibility bar for the zero to one?
Ms. Etheridge.
Thank you. Through the chair, this is Deb Etheridge, Director of the Division of Public Assistance. Zero to one is called what's continuous eligibility, and so if the mother was receiving a Medicaid benefit at time of birth, the child's eligible for Medicaid. And some states operate under an 1115 demonstration waiver to offer continuous eligibility to children beyond age one.
And
follow-up?
Follow-up, if I may. Would you give me more context on that, if you know how many states are continuing beyond age one? Is Alaska unusual in not? So just trying to think about how we can get the most for our children, and if other states are doing it and how that's going, if you know.
Deputy Commissioner.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, for the record, this is Emily Ricci. There are some other states who have pursued what's called, Section 1115 waivers to extend those continuous enrollments. I believe that number is probably less than 10 states who have done that in the U.S. at this point, and I am not aware of if those waivers have actually taken effect.
Okay, thank you. We'll do some research offline. Thank you.
Let's move on to slide 6.
Thank you. For the record, this is Emily Ricci. Moving on to slide 6, Medicaid services, again, this is Medicaid is a joint federal-state program. You'll hear me say that over and over again. But the services that are covered through the Medicaid program occur within the context of guidelines and requirements from the federal government, but are also outlined in state statute. Specifically, services that are covered in Medicaid are outlined in states in Alaska Statute 4707030. And there are really two types of services that are outlined in statute. The first is mandatory services. And these statute requires that Alaska's Medicaid program covers all mandatory services that are part of Title IX of the Social Security Act. In addition, state statute has a list of additional services that are called optional services. But when we think about optional services over time, I think those the sense that those are optional are a little bit of a misnomer for two different reasons. The first is that federal changes through the Affordable Care Act that took effect in 2010 made some of these services that are described as optional in our state statute mandatory at a federal level. The second is that if you look at the list of optional services in state statute, our healthcare delivery system and our expectations for health insurance and our understanding, thinking about the different factors that impacts an individual's health status have evolved, I think, since this statute was written. So services that are considered optional under state statute are things like prescription drugs or emergency hospital services. And, you know, if you think about what a Medicaid program would look like if we did not cover prescription drugs, I think we would see a lot more emergency room utilization visits and other things. So I think we recognize that many of these services, while they may be listed as optional for a variety of reasons, both due to federal regulations and our healthcare delivery system, they're really necessary.
Attorney General, Deputy Commissioner. I'm talking to a lot of people. The topic has come up, and I don't intend to get too bogged down on this, about congressional cuts in the perhaps trillions of dollars to Medicaid. If the statute, which is derived from the 1965 law, I assume our statute, calls for mandatory services, I assume that any administration couldn't reduce the mandatory services because they're mandatory. If rates are slashed, has your office sought a legal opinion on whether or not dollars that have been appropriated, for example, in 2024 through continuing resolution or a budget, can just be reduced? Because it seems like, and again, I don't. This subject sort of came up in subcommittee, and I don't mean to get too bogged down. I want to continue with this, but it seems like that could be critically important to how we cover the 200-plus thousand Alaskans.
Chair Josephson, for the record, this is Emily Ricci. Alaska and every other state is absolutely monitoring the discussions that are happening at the federal level regarding the Medicaid program and other health aspects. I think states tend to monitor those discussions all the time anyway, regardless of how voluminous those discussions are because of the impact and the relationship on Medicaid programs between the state and the federal government. So at this point, we are monitoring, but there have been no specific proposals that have been put forth. And when those specific proposals are put forth, we will work with the Department of Law and others to evaluate the impact to Alaska's Medicaid program.
But just to close this issue out, when monies are transferred to accounts of the state, I don't know if it's the MMIS or what, but when those dollars flow from D.C., you're not seeing any delay, you're not seeing any source of concern yet. Is that fair?
Representative Josephson, Chair Josephson, we have not seen any delay in the drawdown of federal payments for the Medicaid program.
All right, let's go to slide 7.
So moving on to slide 7, how is Medicaid administered? I don't mean to harp on this, but it is a joint state-federal program. So that means that states have flexibility to design their Medicaid programs, as we discussed, subject to approval by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. They are the entity within the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services that administers, that oversees Medicaid and Medicare plans. So as I've stated, Medicare is jointly funded by the federal, by both federal and state governments. And you see here on the right, very, very simplified, high-level diagram of what that process looks like. And so, Chair Josephson, to your point about how the money flows between the federal government and the state, the first step is that the state, and this is managed within the Department of Health, effectively tells the federal government what they anticipate claims costs will be for a specific time period. The federal government kind of makes a note and says, okay, you are authorized to expend this amount of money for the claims that you anticipate seeing. Kind of we've noted that in our system. At that point, the state then pays providers on a weekly basis as they submit claims. That's that $32 million or $52 million check write I spoke about earlier. The state then reports the exact expenditures that were submitted during that weekly check write and then draws the money down from the federal government for the weekly check write that they paid. So this is a very high-level picture. There is a lot of work that happens back and forth at multiple levels between the Department of Health and the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. These expenditures, there's a reconciliation period as well that is also happening ongoing. Providers can submit claims up to there can be adjustments in claims for up to 2 years after a claim is paid out or finalized, and that may depend on a variety of factors. So there are a lot of adjustments to claims and to spend that happen consistently throughout the Medicaid program as that true-up occurs. In addition, the states directly manage or administer the program, managing eligibility, enrollment services, and the enrollment of providers. But the Alaska State Legislature has a really critical role in the Medicaid program. They are approving the budget, approving the optional services that are covered by the Medicaid program, the opportunities for the state to utilize waiver services to cover some of those programs, which we'll talk about a little bit later, as well as the eligibility groups that are covered through the Medicaid program.
Representative Allard.
Thank you, and through the chair, thank you for being here today. So I know you're going to go over the slide about some of the programs. Could you, because I was looking through them, could you be more specific and maybe send us information of what the federal government actually pays for each and every program with a description and the dollar amount?
Through the chair, Representative Allard, we will follow up in writing with a breakout of the federal versus state expenditures by service category.
May I?
Yes, follow up.
I don't need the comparison. I want to know specifically what federal funds go to what programs and the description of those programs.
Through the chair, Representative Allard, okay. We will provide that
information. Thank you.
All right, slide 8.
So moving on to slide 8, a key component of the Medicaid program is the percentage of how the program is financed jointly between the federal government and states. And so the state and federal government effectively establish what the federal share will be for certain costs based on something called the Federal Medicaid Assistance Percentage, or the FMAP. I will refer to this as federal match moving forward. The federal match is calculated each year for each state, and essentially a floor for each state is established annually. We call this in the chart on the right regular Medicaid. So that is the kind of the lowest level of match that the federal government will provide for services. At a minimum, the federal government will pay 50% of the cost for the Medicaid program. But depending on factors specific to each state that are generally economic in nature, that match may be higher. In Alaska, you can see our regular Medicaid, or the floor in terms of what the federal match is for all services, is 51.54%. And it's important to understand that different federal match is available for different types of services. One key difference is different eligibility categories have different federal match rates. So, for example, you see our regular Medicaid at 51.54%. That is the lowest federal match that the state will receive when services are paid out. At the higher end of the spectrum is services that are provided to a tribal health, to a tribal member at a tribal health organization. The state is eligible to receive 100% federal match for those services. But there is a variety in that, and it's important to understand that when we think about the Medicaid budget.
Deputy Commissioner Ritchie, a question from Representative Tomaszewski.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. Through the chair, thank you again for being here. And how well do we make sure that each category fits inside of that category? Like, I love the 100% funding, right? Federal match, that's great. Do we ever find ourselves not getting them in the exact right category, like, whatever the expansion population, I'm hoping that's not the ones who waistlines are expanding, like myself. Sometimes the expansion population. How well are we putting everyone in the correct category to make sure we're getting 100% or 90% or 66.8%?
Through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski. Really, how an individual is the category for federal match that they are aligned to is tied to their enrollment in the Medicaid program effectively. So when they are enrolled in the Medicaid program, they are enrolled through different income or categorical eligibility that then is tracked throughout our system and aligned with their claims. It's possible that there are always errors in our system. I know that's something that the Division of Public Assistance is working through, but we do have auditors that go through on an annual basis to review how accurate our eligibility and enrollment kind of coding has been at the beginning. I would say at the high end, when we think about Indian Health Services and that 100% FMAP, we'll talk about a little bit about this at the slide on the end. That requires some additional work because there are opportunities to receive 100% federal match for services that are provided to a tribal health member that is also Medicaid eligible, but those services may be received outside of the tribal health system. In those cases, if there is a care coordination agreement between the tribal health system and the provider, and if we have a copy of that care coordination agreement, we can go back and we can try to recoup 100% federal match for any Medicaid dollars that were expanded. And that's important. That has been a really important component of the Medicaid system since that became available in 2018. And again, we'll talk about this a little bit later on, but that saved upwards of $138 million in general fund in FY24.
Follow up. So you're making sure, but it's kind of after the fact. Is there any way to be more proactive in making sure that the coding is correct?
through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski, for the vast majority of these services, yes, that occurs, that estimated match for the federal funds is tied directly to the individual's categorical or income eligibility status in the program. However, for certain services specifically related to those Indian health services, there may be additional work that needs to occur to receive that additional federal match. But for the majority, the vast majority of individuals, we are receiving that prospectively.
Thank you. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Josephson. Ms. Ritchie, when the Indian Health Services, because they've expanded in many communities, but in many communities they're the only provider of service. So for a non-tribal citizen receiving care at an Indian Health Service facility, does that matter with regard to what the Medicaid coverage, if they're just regular Medicaid, but they receive services at the Indian Health Service, we still only get reimbursed at 51% versus the 100%?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, that is correct.
Okay. And our one follow-up?
Yes, follow-up.
Are we seeing any complications as Indian Health Service has expanded in providing services in places where they're now SEARCH has stood up a lot of facilities in this region. Is that complicating Medicaid delivery for the non-tribal citizens' service, or is that just on Indian Health Service to figure out that no longer are the majority of the clients walking through the door going to be 100% reimbursement, and some of those are only going to be 51% reimbursement?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, the reimbursement, the federal match, that's really determined by our end in our systems. So there's no change to the Indian, to a tribal health organization in billing Medicaid. They would bill Medicaid for the individual. And we would know on our end whether they are eligible, whether those claims are eligible for a 51% federal match, a 90% federal match, or, some other percentage of a federal match. I think where it can be a little bit complicated is that tribal health organizations are reimbursed differently than non-tribal health organizations. And so the payment shifts in terms of the amount the Medicaid program is paying between tribal health organizations and non-tribal health organizations.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Foster.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just curious to see if there are any flaws in my thinking process on this, and maybe going back to what Co-Chair Josephson was talking about with regard to possible cuts to the Medicaid or the federal match for Medicaid. And looking at this here, we've got the FMAP of 100% for our IHS facilities. So here in Juneau, you've got SEARCH and NOAM. You've got Norton Sound Health Corporation, Manilik. You've got Kotzebue, Yukon Kuskokwim Health Corporation, and Bethel, and so forth. Those hub hospitals, because they do get this 100% FMAP, and the high percentage of folks who are tribally enrolled, they would be very highly impacted, I assume, by, say, a cut of just assuming 50% of the federal match. Am I thinking correctly on that? I mean, I want to say things like I'm alarmed, this could be devastating, but I guess thoughts?
Through the chair, Chair Foster. So the federal match accrues back to the state. From a provider perspective, the Medicaid program pays the Medicaid rates to the provider. It is on the back end that we draw down the federal match for those services. So the difference between federal match for 100% or 50%, that's really a reflection of the impact on the state dollars that are covering those services. But the state will still pay the same amount to the providers, regardless of what the match is. It just allows the state to draw down differing amounts of federal funding to cover those services.
Follow-up, thank you. And at the end of the day, if there is a cut at the federal level, it's either going to mean a diminishment of services or the state's got to pony up the balance, and we've got financial issues of our own. And so I guess I just, maybe not as much of a question as just maybe trying to, I guess, raise the flag on that. So thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to, I just wanted to get the verbiage right. So when it says 100% up there under the FMAP, that's the 100% covered. That's not 100% match. So it's 100% covered. Is that correct? I mean, we're using those words interchangeably, but I don't, I mean, 100% match would be actually the state paying 50% of it. So that's not correct, I think.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson. So 100% FMAP on this chart means that the federal government will reimburse the state for 100% of the amount, of the claim amount that is paid for services, for those services. The 51.4% match means that the federal government will reimburse, 51.54% of the amount paid for services for those individuals.
All right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right, slide 9.
So moving on to slide 9, an important component to understand within the Medicaid program is the Medicaid state plan. So again, this is a joint federal-state program, and the Medicaid state plan is a way that the states essentially outline with the federal federal government what their agreements are within the Medicaid program. So the Medicaid state plan really represents to me an agreement between the state of Alaska and the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services in terms of key elements of the Medicaid program. So it defines who is eligible for Medicaid services. It specifies the types of services that are covered. It outlines how providers are reimbursed for services and how the state will administer those programs. Again, all of that has to occur within federal guidelines, but states do have flexibility, and the Medicaid state plan is how we have those conversations with the federal government for how we administer that program and then make it available so that people can see kind of what the rules are. And moving back to slide 9 for a moment, it's important to understand that any time changes are contemplated in the Medicaid program that impact eligibility, services, administration, rates, those changes generally require a state plan amendment. We call it a SPA. You may hear that. It is not the kind of SPA that you want to go visit. But it is an amendment to the state plan where we're basically going to the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services and saying we need to make this change. We believe it is reasonable and it complies with federal guidelines. And here are the elements to consider. There is a very strict process for how state plan amendments occur. It involves public consultation and tribal consultation over a specified time period. But I think it's important for this committee and for legislators to know that that process must occur before we make changes to the state plan. And if a service is not authorized either through a state plan or through a waiver by the federal government, those services are not eligible for federal match. So from a financial perspective, it's very important to maintain these agreements.
Actually, the committee may want to hear that I was alarmed earlier. This is sort of circa 2019, 2020, when the administration was, for a time, going to remove dental coverage. I think it was preventative dental or something, from Medicaid recipients. And I found that there are some states, very few, that where the legislature can act as a check on SPAs, state plan amendments, and presented to the state of reform on this topic. State of reform is a fall schedule event in Anchorage with insurance industry, providers, et cetera. But am I right about that, Deputy Commissioner, that our system leaves to the governor entirely whether to make adjustments to the state plan without any legislative role in that process? You said there was public and tribal consultation, but the legislature plays no particular role in it. Is that right?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, when I speak with other state Medicaid agencies, one thing that's notable is actually Alaska legislature has a much stronger engagement in the Medicaid program than other state agencies. So, for example, within the state of Alaska, if we seek a waiver for certain Medicaid services, we cannot do that unless that is authorized by statute. In other states, they don't have the same requirements. So, in terms of the state plan agreement, yes, we are as we run a health insurance program effectively, right, we are always making changes and updating state plan agreements as things come up. Those do not typically rise to the level of needing legislative or statutory change. But we cannot, again, add services, eligibility, or other things without coming to the legislature and having that statutory authority. And that is not not necessarily the same for other state systems. So I actually think the legislature has a stronger role in Alaska's Medicaid than what I hear described by other state Medicaid directors.
And that's true as to waivers, but for example, I think I, in a conversation with you or one of your colleagues, I noted that adult podiatry care is not an eligible claim in our system. And I think it is in other systems. If the legislature wanted to provide that, we would need a bill to do that? Is that how we would do that?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, again, we can cover the services that are outlined in the statute that we looked at earlier, right? I'm not going to try to say it off the top of my head, but they include mandatory and optional services. So podiatry is not one of the optional services for adults in state statute. So that's not something that the Medicaid program could unilaterally go and cover without having that statutory authority.
But just to be clear, could the governor, if he chose, go to CMS and say, we, under my authority, without legislative permission or say so, expand and include adult podiatry? I'm just yeah. Theoretically.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, again, as a state agency, we follow what is outlined in state statute. And because adult podiatry is not included as some of the optional services we can cover in state statute, that would require a statutory change before we could pursue a change at the federal level to include that.
Okay. Let's go to slide 10.
One final note I would make on slide 9 is as we think about the state plan amendment, whenever we make state plan amendments, it is very common as well that state regulatory changes are required to follow the state plan amendment. So when we think about making changes to the Medicaid program, you need to think about the time and process it takes to make a state plan amendment and then also regulations to follow that would affect those in Alaska's regulatory structure. So on slide 10, we've talked about state plan amendments as a way to authorize services between the state and federal government that are covered in the Medicaid program. Another opportunity to authorize services within the Medicaid program is through the use of waivers. And there are a lot of different waivers in the Medicaid program. I joke about them being numeric and alphabet soup. The two waivers that we're going to talk about today are ones that are really pretty essential to Alaska's Medicaid program, and these include what we call Section 1115 and Section 1915C waivers. Those numbers refer to the section of federal law that authorizes those waivers. And in general, the U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services is authorized through federal law to grant waivers to states to implement certain Medicaid provisions that may not be typically covered through the Medicaid program. And there are restrictions on these waivers depending on how they are outlined in specific sections of federal law. So the demonstration waivers, the box on the left, you may be familiar with that. That is what the state of Alaska used to expand access to behavioral health and substance use disorder services around 2018 as a result of legislation referred to as SB 74. So demonstration waivers allow for states to effectively offer and cover new services or other items that may not typically be covered by Medicaid in order to demonstrate that they meet the goals of the Medicaid program. There are requirements around demonstration waivers, Section 1115 demonstration waivers. These include budget neutrality requirements for the federal government. They typically last for a 5-year period, demonstration period, and have to be renewed at regular cycles. On the other side, the box on the right, you have program waivers, and these are Section 1915C in Alaska waivers, and these are the waivers that we use to help keep people in their home and in their communities. We call these, you might be familiar with these as home and community-based waiver services. And so both Director Tracy Dompling with the Division of Behavioral Health and Director Tony Newman with the Division of Seniors and Disability Services both manage waivers in each one of these programs. So moving on to slide 11, we're going to start with our 1915C home and community-based waivers, and Director Newman will explain the impact of those in Alaska's Medicaid program.
Director, good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. This is Tony Newman, Director of the Division of Senior Disability Services. And as Deputy Commissioner Ricci indicated, our division oversees administration of Alaska's five 1915C waivers. These offer services to help Alaskans remain in their homes and communities, and we have five waivers in Alaska serving a total of approximately 5,500 Alaskans. I'm going to briefly just give a quick overview of each of the waivers. The first waiver on the list here is the Individuals with Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities, or IDD waiver, serves around 2,100 people. Second, the Alaskans Living Independently waiver is primarily our senior serving waiver, helping Medicaid-eligible seniors with functional challenges live with more independence in their homes and communities. This is our largest waiver, serving about 2,400 people. Third, our Children with Complex Medical Conditions waiver for younger people under age 22 who have a severe chronic medical condition requiring medical care that otherwise would be needed to provide it in a general acute care hospital or a nursing facility if not for home and community-based services. We have about 240 children and young adults served under this waiver. Fourth, the Individualized Supports waiver is our newest waiver, introduced as part of Medicaid reforms in 2018. Also serves people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, but offers a lighter menu of services for people who are eligible. About 600 people are served by this waiver. And finally, fifth, our Adults with Physical and Developmental Disabilities waiver serves about 176 adults, often people who have aged out of our other waivers who meet a nursing home level of need. So you see these waivers serve different populations, but they have a couple of things in common. First, what being on a waiver means is that people have access to a menu of potential services that can help them live independently. There are about 14 waiver services ranging from habilitative care that can be provided at home or in an assisted living home, to employment services to help people gain job skills and find success in the workplace, from adult daycare services to environmental modification services that help pay for labor and materials for things like ramps and roll-in showers to help people live as independently as possible. Also, to be eligible for these waivers requires that someone be eligible for a category of Medicaid that is determined by the Division of Public Assistance and Director Etheridge's shop, and then be assessed as meeting a level of care requirement, which we do at Senior and Disability Services. And here I want to thank the legislature for appropriating funding beginning in FY24 and continuing through FY26 for us to modernize our assessment instruments by adopting a new tool called the NRI. This tool will put the division in a better direction to make a number of systemic improvements that have long been sought by our stakeholders. And last and probably the most important thing to say about the waivers is how much sense they make financially and in the lives of people who benefit from them. Without these waivers, these individuals would need to rely on institutional care. And we are fond at the department of saying that waivers are savers because without them, Alaska would have to rely on more and more expensive care in nursing homes and institutions for people with disabilities. We estimate that Alaska would spend over $1 billion in institutional care than if we did not have waiver services. So in other words, thanks to these waivers, we avoid spending around $600 million. But the best part is that waivers allow Alaskans to live in their own homes and communities with the lifestyle they choose to live with the supports that they identify.
Thank you, Director. We've been joined by Representative Stapp. We have questions from Representative Hannon, then Galvin.
Thank you, Chair Joseph, and good morning, Mr. Newman. I am not sure if this is accurate, but when we hear from constituents who are talking about being on an IDD wait list, is this the wait list here on this waiver? And if so, what is it that needs to be done from us to move people into that so they're covered? Because, again, saves us money in the long run and makes for better communities. So how do we get more people that are on the IDD wait list off of that and into service?
Through the Chair, Representative Hannon, yes, you're correct. That first waiver at the top of the list there, the individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities has the wait list. Last time I checked, it was about 323 individuals in late January, but it changes almost on a daily basis. In 2022, the legislature asked us to put together a plan for what it would cost to eliminate the wait list. And that that plan is available on the website. It describes the appropriations that would be needed to eliminate the wait list. We, in that plan, we laid out a plan that would do it in a more cost-effective manner by introducing the new assessment tool I just mentioned. So by implementing that tool, we would be able to reduce the cost of eliminating the wait list significantly. I want to say that the legislature funded only the implementation of the tool to actually provide the services and to bring people off the wait list require additional appropriations that are described in that report.
Thank you.
If the legislature, and I think we talked about this in the subcommittee, and it was about $30 million or something, to eliminate the wait list. If the legislature did that, would there be instant savings over and above some other form of institutional care?
Through the chair, Mr. Chairman, if I may repeat the question, would eliminating the wait list offer savings in other areas?
I guess what I mean is we're waiting on the application of the inter-I, and we've talked about the inter-I, but if we were impatient and we said, we don't want to deal with the inter-I. We want to reduce the wait list to zero. Would we realize savings instantly over what's happening today by serving the 323 on the wait list?
Mr. Chairman, I think that would be difficult to say because the wait list is we draw people from the wait list based on their priority level of need. So the people that are still remaining on the wait list have the lowest level of need that's been identified. We did implement the individualized supports waiver in 2018 to offer a lighter menu of services. So I want to be clear that many of the people who are on the wait list are receiving services already. They're receiving services in many cases through that individualized supports waiver.
Okay. Representative Galvin.
Thank you. Through the chair, I wonder if we could have the 2022 plan or report that you put out to help us understand how to remove the wait list could be sent to the chair, to all of us. Again, I wasn't here then, but I'm real curious to look at that, and I understand that we would need to refresh and take off one of the pretty substantial costs. So if we could have that, if that's amenable to the chair.
Mr. Chair, yes. We could certainly provide that report.
Thank you. And follow-up. With regard to lighter menu of services, would you elaborate on that? And with that, does that also save us, from other costs? And if what the gap would be to fill in from lighter to the substantial, whatever services or others are receiving?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, yes. The when I refer to a lighter menu of services, what I'm primarily referring to is residential services that are provided under the Individuals with Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities waiver that are not provided under the Individualized Supports waiver. So that's where the lighter menu of services primarily derives from. Those residential services are among the more expensive and intensive services that are provided through the IDD waiver. I'll say that the individualized supports waiver was implemented in part because it did represent savings of state funds. We were able to reduce general grant funding by the implementation of that waiver.
Thank you.
If resources were unlimited, of course they're not, would the removal of the wait list, do we have the resources? Here I don't mean financial, I mean human capital. Do we have the buildings, the homes, the staff, do we have those services to eliminate the wait list?
Mr. Chairman, that's an excellent point. That would be a concern that the service providers, and that's primarily direct support workers, would need to be available. So we could eliminate the wait list by offering everyone a spot on the waiver and the ability to access the services. But if the workforce isn't there, then there's, in effect, another wait list remaining.
Representative Stapp.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Justin, through the chair to Director Newman. Again, always a pleasure to see you. How many other states have a wait list for IDD folks like we do?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, a significant number. I believe last time I checked it was several dozen. In fact, my nephew was on the wait list in Pennsylvania for many years.
And a follow-up, Mr. Kutcher.
Follow-up.
And do we have a, I know this is in the study, but just so we can put it on the record, what is the average time that someone spends on the IDD wait list here in Alaska?
Mr. Chairman, we do have that. We do have that number. I don't have it at my fingertips, but we could provide that to the committee.
Okay.
Are there no wait lists for the other four programs?
Mr. Chairman, we recently implemented a wait list for the individualized supports waiver. That is a small wait list right now because we're capped at 600 people. It's about 45 people at the moment.
Okay. All right. Seeing no, Representative Tomaszewski.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson, through the chair. So waivers or savers? It says here $600 million. I may have missed it. Are those federal dollars, state dollars, general fund dollars, or federal dollars, or how does that break out?
Through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski, those are both state and federal dollars.
And is it, follow-up? Is it dependent on the program, or how do you break that down?
Oh, Mr. Chairman, we calculate that number by looking at the number of people on the wait list. Looking at the number of people on each waiver, comparing that with the average costs for institutional care, and making a determination: what would these people cost in a nursing home? What would they cost in an institution for people with disabilities if they weren't able to receive home and community-based services?
Okay, and follow up. So I just thank you. Thank you for that. How much of it is federal and how much of it is general fund?
Through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski, roughly 51%, as Deputy Commissioner Ricci noted earlier. 51% federal.
So they fall under that lowest category, the basement level?
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Okay, thank you.
All right. We have about 20 minutes, but we're going to get there. And then we'll be proud of ourselves. We'll know that we got there and went through this and we'll set off the day from there. Slide 12.
Good morning. For the record, Tracy Dompling. I'm the director of the Division of Behavioral Health. I'm going to speak a little bit this morning about Alaska's behavioral health system and the public funds that support that system. Our behavioral health system in Alaska really started redesign and reform in 2016 with the passage of SB 74. I want to take an opportunity again to thank the legislature for passing this important bill. What it did was it required the department to pursue an 1115 waiver to improve and modernize the Medicaid behavioral health system of care in Alaska. This also included increasing the overall funding in the system to sustainable funding sources where federal contributions could be leveraged. So looking at this overall slide, this is the combination of Medicaid and grants that have been contributing to Alaska's behavioral health care system from federal year fiscal year 18 through state fiscal year 18 through state fiscal year 24. Want to take a look first at the Medicaid funding. So starting with the brownish-colored sections, those are state plan behavioral health services, the lighter sections being the state portion and the darker portion being the federal. Moving on to the blue categories, those are the 1115 services, with the lighter-colored services being the state portion and then the darker color being the federal portion. Some things to note in there, you can start to see when the 1115 services started to come online. First, those were the substance use disorder demonstration waiver, which was late in FY 20 when that came online. And then later in FY 21, towards the end of that fiscal year, we had the mental health services that came online. And I did want to note that there was a bit of a bifurcation in that waiver to have the separation between the substance use disorder and the mental health services, and that was a direct response to the state, the emerging opioid epidemic within Alaska was bringing on those substance use disorder services first. The green line represents the grant funds that were appropriated by the legislature to the division to disperse to community behavioral health services providers throughout Alaska. Then lastly, the numbers that are bolded at the top of each of the columns, that's the overall spend that we've seen from FY18 to FY24, really representing about a $120 million increase, which is about 48%. And we can certainly attribute the Section 1115 demonstration waiver as part of that. As Deputy Commissioner Ricci said earlier, demonstration waivers have a limited amount of time, and the first one was for 5 years. We were able to have a renewal of that demonstration waiver, so the current waiver now goes through December 31st of 2028. But this renewal of the waiver actually gives us opportunity for amendments to really expand out and fine-tune our existing 1115 waiver to ensure that we are supporting and addressing gaps within Alaska's behavioral health system.
Okay. Question from Representative Galvin. We need to move along, though, so keep it tight.
I'm sorry, what did you say? I didn't hear that.
Just get right into your question. And
the question is about the green line, the grants, the federal, state, and if you could give us context on why it reduced so significantly.
Through the chair to Representative Galvin, a lot of that is federal funds. So the Division of Behavioral Health receives block grants for substance use as well as mental health, and so those are received each year by the division, and so that is the majority of those funds. There's also, and I don't have it with me, but we could certainly provide it if needed, the breakdown of what the state appropriations are that are going towards those grants as well. And then the decrease in those grants is really the shift from some of those grant services initially, for example, children's residential type services that were being funded through grants. As those started to shift into the 1115 waiver and being able to bill Medicaid for those services is when we see those reductions in those the use of grants to support the system. But even with those reductions, we still see that increase of overall spend in the behavioral health system over the last 7 fiscal years.
Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson, and through the chair. The dollars being shown here are independent of any other agencies within the state that are providing these types of services, for example, mental health trusts and or our education departments that are dealing in mental health and or this particular space. Is that accurate?
Through the chair to Representative Bynum. Primarily, yes, it is separate from those. There are times where the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority will appropriate funds to the Division of Behavioral Health for specific things, which then may be granted out. One example was crisis services.
Yes, follow.
So that would fall under the grant component here?
Through the chair to Representative Bynum, yes.
Thank you. Ms. Dompling. What would we see in FY26 on the green line, do you know?
Mr. Chair, no, off the top of my head, I actually don't know what we're looking at for FY26. I know that we do have some reduction to our COVID-19 supplemental funds, and I think Deputy Commissioner Ricci has some additional information.
Deputy Commissioner.
Chair Josephson, for the record, this is Emily Ricci. If we can speak about that maybe during this afternoon's overview of the DBH budget, I think that might be helpful in terms of time.
Quick question for me, and then we'll go to Representative Jimmy. About 5 years ago, when I was chair of the subcommittee, I had sort of greater concentrated knowledge about this and offered amendments in finance, one failed by a single vote. To increase the behavioral health grants, the typical cash grants. And what we were hearing from groups under the Behavioral Health Association umbrella was that there were services that simply couldn't meet the requirements of this of these waivers. And the one that jumps to mind is capacity. So what we learned was that to start up a new behavioral health clinic, for example, those costs were not covered costs. But there were assorted other things like this. Should we still be concerned, or has the system evolved such that the 1115 waiver, I mean, I can see that there's more dollars in the system. That's good. Is there remaining concern about folks with unmet needs who can't qualify for waiver coverage?
Chair Josephs, and for the record, this is Emily Ricci. We continue to see gaps in the continuum of care for the behavioral health system, and part of one of the arcs of effort within the Department of Health is to strengthen the behavioral health care system. So it's important to see how far we've come with the implementation of the 1115 waiver for behavioral health services, but we know that there's additional work that has to be done. And so I know Director Dompling and the Division of Behavioral Health has undertaken work to kind of outline a strategic plan to address that in collaboration with our partners. Part of that is through the Youth Behavioral Health Roadmap that we worked on last year and was finalized. Part of that as well is through a recent assessment from Milliman to outline opportunities to improve our crisis continuum. So there's kind of a consistent desire and focus on improving and addressing those gaps in the behavioral health continuum.
Okay. We'll talk more. It looks like you have something more to add. Okay. Representative Jimmy.
Thank you, Co-Chair Andy Josephson, and through the chair. I just had a quick question. Out in where I represent, we have a high Medicaid of participants, and with that, with them being involved with school, is there any way that they can, would there be a way to hire counselors out there for schools?
Through the chair, Representative Jimmy, for the record, this is Emily Ricci. The department is working to build out something called school-based services, so to support schools in providing services to individuals in the school system. We received a $2.5 million grant from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services last year, and through the passage of legislation last year, we were able to kind of remove some state limitations in how school districts could leverage opportunities in the Medicaid program. So a short answer is that we are working to build that out currently.
I'll follow up.
Yes, follow up.
And that's just not that, and that's for the whole state of Alaska, correct?
Through the chair, Representative Jimmy, that is correct.
Thank you.
Okay, let's go to slide 13.
For the record, this is Emily Ricci with the Department of Health, and slide 13 is just really a timeline. For the sake of time, I will just touch on it briefly, that outlines some of the major developments in the Medicaid program in Alaska, and I wanted to include this because this does have an impact on the enrollment within the Medicaid program as well as the overall budget of the Medicaid program. And so the Medicaid program was established in 1965. Alaska joined the Medicaid program in 1972. Most recently, in 2015, Alaska expanded Medicaid eligibility through the Affordable Care Act. In 2018, as you heard from Director Dompling, the 1115 waiver for behavioral health services was approved. In 2020, for the public health emergency, the federal government required states to maintain enrollment in the Medicaid program, and states were only allowed to disenroll individuals for very specific purposes. At the same time, the federal government authorized a 6.2% enhanced federal match across the board to help offset the cost of maintaining that enrollment. In April of 2023, that match began to step down over four quarters, and states were required to redetermine enrollment for all Medicaid enrollees. And that was a historic effort that was challenging for many states. And as we move into slide 14, some of those events that I've described in the timeline align with some of what you see here in this chart. So this chart is a high-level overview of Medicaid enrollment as well as spending. And so I'm going to start by talking about the gold and the green lines. Those depict enrollment in the Medicaid program. So that gold line is the number of enrollees in the Medicaid program. I would note that you'll see enrollees are upwards of about 280,000 in FY 2024 on that slide. That number includes any individual who is enrolled at any point of time in the Medicaid program during that year. But if we look at month-to-month enrollments, the number is lower. So, for example, in April of 2023, when the state began its process of redetermining eligibility, Medicaid enrollment was around 253,000 in April individuals. As of December 2024, that number was 246,000. So the number of individuals on a monthly basis who are enrolled in the Medicaid program falls within that bandwidth. Below that, the green line is the number of individuals who have actually received a service. So these are individuals who are enrolled in the Medicaid program, and they've received a service. So not everyone who is enrolled in the Medicaid program actually incurs costs or goes to the doctor or receives a service. And that's important to understand when you're thinking about budget. The bars at the bottom, the dark blue line represents the federal portion of the state Medicaid budget, and the light blue line represents the state portion of the Medicaid budget. And so you can see over the last probably 8 years specifically, a federal portion of the Medicaid budget has grown much faster than the state portion has.
Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Justice, and through the chair, just briefly. So we definitely have a gap between those being enrolled and also then receiving care. Are there any requirements in our plans that people, the enrollees, receive preventative care?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, there's no requirement that an enrollee go to the doctor and get preventative care, but that is an option for them.
Thank you.
Slide, are we ready for Representative Hannon?
Thank you, Chair Josephson. Representative Bynum asked the first half of my question. But besides preventative care, because some of our slides are about chronic conditions and management of those, so if somebody is an enrollee and is a chronic condition, do we try and encourage them to get care so that we are managing their condition versus having a catastrophic medical outcome by not managing a condition?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, there are some programs for individuals that have very severe or acute needs, but I think that's an area that we really want to focus on from the department is how do we help support individuals that have chronic conditions or who do not in staying healthy and getting the care that they need.
One follow-up.
Thank you, Chair Josephson. And do we hear from enrollees that that gap is because they can't get to services? They live in a remote community. The follow-up would require them to travel and find care for their children at home and those kinds of complications? Or do we not know why people aren't, why there's that gap between the enrollees and the recipients?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, we don't know. There could be many reasons why there is that gap. I would say in general, I come from the state and from the self-insured side, managing self-insured plans in the past, and there is typically a gap between the number of individuals who are covered in a health insurance plan and the number of individuals who are using services. I think what's notable is that that gap has grown over time, and that's important as we just think about the impacts on the Medicaid budget and the population.
Thank you.
Representative Galvin, then Stapp.
Thank you, through the chair. I know it's early, but on the continuous care for the 11-15 waivers for postpartum care for the mother and child, have you found that there has been fewer costs of emergency care as opposed to preventative care?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, again, I don't know how many states have actually implemented that continuous coverage yet.
Sorry,
so
just
I'm
the
not
zero
sure.
to one.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, we can follow up with that information.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Okay. Let's go to slide 15, which looks – oh, sorry, Representative Stapp.
Thank you, Chair Jefferson. I'll be really quick through the chair to Ms. Ritchie. How much leeway do we have? Obviously, having a self-insured background, being Alaska Care, there's a lot that you can do on a plan to, let's say, incentivize preventative care, high wellness exams and stuff like that. How much leeway do we have with the state plan to be able to put those kind of standard mechanisms that we'd see on a standard self-funded plan to try to create that behavior among participants through the chair?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, I think that we would have a lot of leeway to do that. I think some of that comes down to bandwidth within the division and, certainly a goal moving forward.
Okay. Looks like slide 15 should be fast.
Sure. Slide 15, these are just some of the different influences in the Medicaid budget. It can be very complex. We can think about things like inflation impacting the budget. We've talked a lot about the federal match and enrollment, the underlying population health. Impacts the utilization of services within a health insurance plan and the Medicaid budget, and then the amount and how we pay for services is an influence. So moving on to slide 16, one of the things that we have been tracking, particularly as we have gone through redetermining eligibility over the last 2 years, is how many individuals are receiving services, and are we seeing a drop in the number of individuals who are receiving services at any given time? And really what this chart shows is that there's been relative stability there between probably about a 2,000 per month average difference.
Okay, next slide.
So moving on to slide 7, I think it makes sense. We all recognize that individuals who have chronic conditions need more medical services, and that can result in higher costs to pay for those services. And this is just a depiction, again, of how the association between cost and chronic conditions and the focus areas on our end of trying to support individuals in managing their chronic conditions and keeping our population healthy.
Slide 18.
And then slide 18, I'm going to start by talking about the bar on the right. Again, as a standard with insurance plans, generally a small portion of the population attributes a larger portion of total spending, and a larger portion of the population is attributable to a smaller portion of spending. So if you see here, the gold bar in the chart on the right represents about 10% of total recipients in the Medicaid program using services, but the services they use account for approximately 67% of total spending, and that is around $1.8 billion in the Medicaid system. At the lower end of the spectrum, you see about 60% of total recipients who account for about 7% of spending. And again, this is not unusual to see relationships like this. The pie chart on the left is just another way to kind of think about the impact of that 10% versus the 60%.
Right, slide 19.
Moving on to 19, another impact on the Medicaid budget, of course, is how we reimburse for services. So this is a very, very simplified slide for how the system works. But on the left-hand side, you see the different types of rates that could be paid to different types of providers, depending on the services that they are offering. And then the slide on the right talks about some of the typical adjustments that we can make on an annual or a one-off basis relative to inflation, rebasing based on cost, legislative appropriation, or federal changes.
Inflation and rebasing are linked, aren't they, in some way?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, inflationary adjustments, as outlined generally through regulation, occur on an annual basis. Rebasing is a process that evaluates underlying costs for an organization offering services on a longer basis, typically 3 to 5 years. So they both reflect increasing costs or cost changes, I should say, in the delivery of service, but they represent different aspects of the rate-setting process.
Okay. And slide 20 we talked about earlier.
Yes, correct.
And these are savings from reclaiming, et cetera.
Correct. We do try to be efficient with Medicaid dollars, and you can see here on the left two important sources of savings for the Medicaid program is the use of tribal reclaiming, so leveraging that 100% federal match for certain services. In fiscal year 2024, that was $138 million. On the right, we also pursue drug rebates and recoveries. Those savings are shared between the federal government and the state government, but they are also important to offsetting the cost of services in the Medicaid program, and they accounted for about $135 million in FY24. There's actually supplemental drug rebates that we received as well, so that number is actually closer to $168 million in reality.
Okay. All right. It's our good fortune, Deputy Commissioner, that we have you back this afternoon to talk about your budget. This was policy-oriented with a little bit of attention to budget. But this afternoon we'll get into increments and decrements and the like with this department. I want to thank you, Deputy Commissioner Emily Ricci. You've got a great team there. And, of course, a great commissioner. Our next scheduled House Finance Committee meeting is at 1:30 this afternoon. And as I said, we'll be hearing the DOH FY26 budget overview. We will adjourn this meeting at 10:31.